Hi, this is Chuck Noll. Welcome to another episode of Getting Your Dough to Rise. Well, wasn't it a pleasure driving up to the studio today? You could just about see the mountains. And I need to tell you, first of all, if you were listening to the show, because Robert Krughoff was going to be here, who is the editor of the Puget Sound Consumer's Checkbook. Well, we had to put that off for a while because Robert is somewhere in the mountains on the East Coast, and we just didn't want to take a chance on doing an interview by cell phone when he's driving through the mountains. So hopefully he'll be back with us in a month or two, and we'll be talking about the latest Puget Sound Consumer's Checkbook, which involves such things as rating physicians and supermarkets. And by the way, I noticed that you can get Tillamook ice cream at the, I believe it was the QFC supermarket this week, and the flyers that just came out on Tuesday today. I always enjoy going through the flyers when they come to the mailbox on Tuesday. I have in my studio today Bill Smead, who is the founder and CEO and CIO of Smead Capital Management in Seattle, and he's also the portfolio manager of the Smead Value Fund. And in about 10 minutes, we'll be talking with Michael Parks, the editor emeritus of the Marple's Northwest Business Letter in Seattle. First of all, though, let's go to Bill, and let's talk about the Value Fund, the Smead Value Fund that you run, Bill. Thanks for joining me here on a nice day like today. Remind us what value means compared to growth.
Well, thanks, Chuck. Value, for the most part, means that you're going to rely on the academic studies that have shown that what you pay to buy into a business is a big factor on what your long-term returns might be. Numerous studies by Fama French and Bauman and David Dreeman and others have showed if you buy in the lower price-earnings ratios, the lower price-to-book ratios, et cetera, that you will earn significantly more returns than you would if you just tried to guess which companies are going to grow the most. Because the studies show that out of every 100 companies, about the same amount of good luck comes out of each set of 100. So if you're going to get average luck, you want to pay a below average price.
Well, I know 10 years ago or so, there was quite an argument as to which was a better investment, value or growth stocks. And then now over, I'd say, the last 10 years, it seems like value has been the winning camp. Couldn't growth come back into vogue as being the better place to be?
Well, it's a great question. And in our fund, if folks take a look at the holdings in our fund, for example, if they go to Morningstar or one of the services to take a look, you'll find that it's the initial purchases, the original point at which you entered into the stock, that really is the hallmark of the effective value manager. However, if a company succeeds for many, many years and you entered at a value price, but you hold and allow the growth and success of the company in combination with the value purchase, you can have a very powerful double whammy. And we really attempt to do that in the operating of our fund. There was a portfolio manager that retired a couple of years ago that had run a successful mid-cap fund for T. Rowe Price, a guy named Jack LaPorte. He had a great 15-year track record, and they asked him, Jack, why do you think you did so well? And he said, well, we just held our winners a lot longer than everybody else. So a combination of being an effective value buyer with the willingness to ride through some of the ups and downs of the growth phase of a company, we think is a pretty potent combination.
Well, speaking of holding on to your winners, that seems to be even a more important consideration is when to sell your asset as compared to when to buy it, and a more difficult decision, I would think.
Well, I'm somewhat of a controversial character in that I believe that scarcity adds value and scarce behaviors add value. So what we've had between 1999 and 2009, the stock market in the United States did very poorly. In a 10-year stretch where the stock market did poorly, people have attempted to compact the time that they own a stock, because gains were so fleeting when you're having an occasional bear market of magnitude like we had from 2000 to 2002 and then from 2007 to 2009, the willingness to hold on to large unrealized gains went away. And so people have shrank their time frame. Well, when all the other investors are shrinking their time frame, from a scarcity standpoint, that's the ideal time to expand your time frame. So we think that one of the biggest mistakes being made in the marketplace right now with the invention of ETFs, exchange-traded funds, and all these other short-term oriented vehicles by which you can participate, that the person that identifies an outstanding company gets to buy into it at a value price and then is shepherded through owning it for maybe as long as 10 or 20 years, think of that, Chuck, that they might reap unusual benefits in that very few other investors are willing to practice buy and hold discipline right now, because buy and hold is always way out of favor after a 10-year poor stretch like that.
What is your average hold in your mutual fund?
Well, the fund is 3 years, a little over 3 years old, but the last 2 years, our turnover was around 14%. If you practice 14% turnover for 7 years,
that's a 7 year hold.
That's a 7 year hold.
Right.
You can't say it's 7 years yet, but if we keep the same kind of behavior pattern that we've had the last couple of years for the next 5 years, we'd like to think when we buy into a stock that it's going to be a very successful stock. They're kind of on probation, but the ones that do work, we'll probably own them for a long time. And we own some names in there that are very, very, it's pragmatic to think of owning for a long time, a Disney or a Starbucks or a Walgreens. I mean, those are companies that have not only been around a while, but also they're very highly likely to succeed and not see their customer base disappear in a difficult economic environment.
Well, now you said this fund started up about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bit slight on the track record basis, but I also noticed 3 years ago. How 3 years in what?
3 years. Well, it was incepted January 2 of 2008, so it's 3 years and 4 months old.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Bottom of the stock market, March of 2008?
March of 2009.
March of 2009.
Yeah, so we absorbed the brunt of the first year that we had the fund was that incredibly difficult stretch. And it for long-term investors that own quality, want to buy and hold, we were pretty fully invested that whole year, and that's reflected in our three-year numbers.
That's right.
But that's okay.
I was giving you more credit than I should have for getting in and starting your fund at the right time.
Well, yeah, we'd have been geniuses if we started January of 2009.
Right.
But that's okay, because we plan on doing this for a long, long time, and all that will ultimately come out in the wash over 20 or 25 years.
Well, now, when you invest in stocks, do you invest in companies overseas?
For the most part, no. We, from time to time, will own an ADR, a foreign company that trades here on the New York Stock Exchange. It would more than likely be a business that does a primary part of its revenues and profits in the United States of America. So, in the past, we've owned Toyota, for example.
Some of the drug companies.
We might screen the drug companies, Unilever or Nestle or someone like that. But at the current time, we own 29 securities and none of them are foreign. Of course, we own a lot of outstanding companies that do a lot of business around the world that are multinational. But for the most part, we're a U.S. large cap value fund.
And what would you do in a situation where you did not? Well, let me ask you first, what's your percentage in cash right now?
About 1.5%.
Okay, so not even in a position, if you really like something, that you have much sitting in the cash drawer to take advantage of it. You'd have to sell off something else.
Yeah, that's our turnover. We spend a lot more time trying to figure out where we're wrong than where we're right. So when we buy a new security, we get about three good new ideas in a typical year, and that's where the 14% turnover comes from. That means that if we're going to add three names to the portfolio, we more than likely have to reduce or eliminate three names, and therefore that's where the turnover comes from. So it usually, I'd say the typical thing is to try to figure out maybe where we've been someplace for 3 years and it's just not come to be a good performer for us, and maybe we decide that whatever our line of reasoning ended up not being valid.
Now, later on in the program, after the interview that's coming up on the phone, you are going to present a couple of scenarios that might happen. And I would think that if we get close to the happening, that you would maybe go to 5, 10, 15% cash?
Well, that's a great question, Chuck. I think you're kind of hinting at some what we consider to be the biggest risks in the marketplace. And for the most part, we own companies that we think are well insulated from what we see the biggest risk of the next 2 or 3 years, and we'll all explain that in detail later on.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So you're fine with your portfolio, even in the worst case, well, not the worst case scenario, but the kind of scenarios that you're suspecting might occur.
Right.
Okay. Well, by the way, just to go off subject a bit, just before we go to our interview on the phone, I noticed the other day when I was shopping coming out of the store that there were these really cute gold bags available that when you scissor them open and you find out what's inside, it tells you on the outside it's fast cash in less than a week. And all you have to do is put anything that you have is made of gold in this envelope and mail it off to this company, and then they're going to send you money for it. Can you imagine someone actually doing this?
Well, yeah, I can. Remember, it hasn't been that many years that people put thousands of dollars into untested dot-com companies that had no sales and no earnings under the premise that they were going to make them wealthy. You know, the internet.
Yeah, but those were on the market. I mean, at least they had some kind of.
Well, but very few of those are still in business.
Right. But, I mean, just to mail this thing off to some place that you don't even know anything about. I did Google it.
Yeah.
I would hope anybody that was going to try to figure out how much that old gold ring might be worth would at least Google the name of this company and find out if there's many complaints online about it. But
your guest that couldn't make it today would have been a good person to ask that question. He probably has a better Business Bureau check on that particular company.
I just can't believe someone would pick this up and put their treasure in there and mail it off to a place, who knows what it is, a post office box or something.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, let's see here. I guess we still have a minute or so, but I don't want to get into China yet. I would like to ask you, you're going to do a seminar. This is tomorrow, right?
Right.
On a lot of topics. Why don't you pick up on something here that you might want to just spend a minute or two on before we go to the interview?
Yeah, it's on statistical outliers. And we just kind of see a lot of very unusual, emphatic activity in a large number of areas. And what we're trained to do is if people are super enthusiastic about something, like gold, for example, it's not that they're not going to go up more. It's just that we're trained to avoid that kind of enthusiasm. We go by we want to be fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful. And so we're going to talk about 7 different categories where either there's way too much enthusiasm right now and we want to stay away from it, or there's way too much pessimism right now and we would like to take advantage of it.
This is a reversion to the mean investing.
Exactly.
And that works perfectly as long as whatever the particular asset is, it doesn't go totally out of style, buggy whips or something.
Yeah, that's right. And patience is a big factor. It's funny you mention that because we have energy and oil on our list, and who knows, in 20 years we all might be using electricity in our cars instead of gasoline, and they might be more like the buggy whip.
Well, I believe it's time to go to the. We're first going to go to traffic and weather, and then after that, we'll be back and we'll be talking with Mike Parks.
And you are listening to Getting Your Dough to Rise here on Independent Public Radio, 90.7 FM KSER. Our guest is Bill Speed of Speed Capital Management. And if you have questions, you can prepare them. Write down the phone number, 425-303-9070. Right now, Seattle into Everett is a 30-minute drive. Bellevue into Everett is 31 minutes. Everett into Seattle is 30 minutes. And Everett into Bellevue is 28 minutes. For tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of some evening showers. Low temperature in the upper 30s to the mid-40s. Rain likely tomorrow. The high temperature in the upper 40s to the mid-50s. Showers likely on Thursday and a rumor of sunshine for the weekend. Tonight, cloudy, chance of showers, low in the 30s, and right now it is 55 degrees on KSER.
And we're back again, and we will be going to Michael Parks. In fact, Mike is on the phone with us right now. Hi there, Mike. How are you?
I'm good, and it's nice to hear Bill Smead's voice on the line.
Yes, I understand the two of you have been in each other's company before.
It's been a while, but yes, indeed. I know Bill, and I'm sure Bill has heard of my me.
Yeah, that's great.
Have you got nice weather down there, too?
The sun is shining, as best I can tell, and actually, I was at Green Lake this morning when it was cloudy, and all things equal, I probably should have been there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It looked a lot nicer.
Well, I thought I'd ask because sometimes the weather is so localized that you could possibly have a shower down there at this point. I don't know.
I can hardly wait for some sunshine and some spring, and I'm sure that resonates.
Well, you know, first of all, let me mention to the listeners that Mike is the editor emeritus of Marple's Northwest Business Letter in Seattle, and you've recently pretty much been dedicating yourself, I believe, to the seminar circuit?
Yes, I'm a public speaker, a webmaster. I have my own website, MichaelJParks.com, all run together. And I continue to consult with the people who purchased Marple's letter in September of 2009, so about 18 months ago, advised them and help them, but primarily now a public speaker.
Well, this is my primary question to you, and that is quite often deride anecdotal evidence, but in your case, I think I'd like to get some. When you're on your circuit, and I'm sure rubbing shoulders with a lot of the business community, what is the feeling you get in terms of the turnaround of the economy, at least in the Northwest?
Well, people are, you know, they're curious. People are curious, certainly about the decline of the dollar and what we're seeing in food stores and at the gasoline station. I get questions about the relationship between the United States and China, which I think is, you know, tremendously important. It's having a particular impact in the Pacific Northwest right now. A couple of years ago, China, which had been out of the U.S. market for a number of years, popped up as a big importer of softwood logs from Western Oregon and Western Washington, and all of a sudden the sawmills are having to compete with the Chinese buyers for logs. So it's having an impact. The timber owners love it because the price of logs has gone up. I think export of logs from Washington and Oregon last year up something like 40%, and the Chinese are big in that market. China's become an important factor for Pacific Northwest agriculture, which is big and important for more important than we city folk generally recognize. But, you know, people are concerned. You know, my take is that things have turned around on Wall Street. They've turned around for the banking system. But as anybody who looks at housing prices and the job market knows, it's still a pretty slow recovery on Main Street. Chuck, it's an interesting time. Yesterday's Wall Street Journal featured the opinions of Bill Gross, who runs the Globe's largest fixed income fund, as opposed to the opinions of a fellow by the name of Rick Ryder, who runs a big fixed income fund for BlackRock. And what's interesting about the contrast is that they're at opposite ends when it comes to whether or not the end of QE2, the quantitative easing that the Fed is doing today, what sort of an impact that will have on the bond market. Bill Gross is so concerned that interest rates are going to shoot up that he's actually dumped all of his Treasury securities and, in fact, has gone short the Treasury market.
Mike, this is Bill.
Yep.
I read that article, and terrific terrific debate there.
We've
talked a lot about that in our work, and we actually theorized that in effect eliminating QE2 could be like taking the training wheels off as your 3 or 4 or 5 year olds learning to ride a 6 year old riding a bicycle. What's interesting is, you know, if you take it off and the economy stumbles, what's there to stop the Fed from putting it back on,
right,
you know, once the stumble's obvious?
Sure.
But we have a theory that and it's kind of somewhere in between those two camps that by keeping short rates artificially low for so long that countries and businesses that are capital intensive or absorb capital have had a huge advantage here, because obviously the price of capital is interest rates, and it's very, very low.
Sure.
So capital is like water. So if you're an emerging market nation that just chews up capital like crazy, like China you mentioned,
sure,
or if you're a capital intensive business, this is the best of times. If you saw the report from Cummins Engine today or recent reports from people like Caterpillar,
sure,
and John Deere. On the other hand, if you're a strong balance sheet company, you earn almost no interest on your money like a Microsoft. And then secondarily, if you generate massive amounts of free cash flow, who cares about massive free cash flow and having the ability to fund yourself? Because any small to mid-cap company can go to the bank right now and borrow all the money they want if,
sure,
they're creditworthy for, say, 5% interest, which is historically pretty low.
Right.
So any thoughts on that, on that capital intensive versus non-capital intensive? And then also my question for you is just, it looks like Boeing's on the upswing. Shouldn't that be pretty positive, even for the housing part of the local economy? Shouldn't that be a positive?
It should, although I haven't seen the numbers yet, but I heard today that the S&P Case-Shiller numbers showed that housing values in the Seattle area are still declining. On the capital side, Bill, what I tell people, Bill Gross said he's worried about a default by the U.S., and he says there are many ways that the U.S. can default on its obligations, and one of them is by reducing the purchasing power of the dollar. And I tell people that, in effect, what we have today is a default in the sense that returns to savers, as you mentioned, returns to companies that have a lot of cash, are artificially low. You know, ask your relative who's in her 70s or 80s who is trying to roll over a CD that was issued 3 or 4 years ago if she doesn't feel a sense of default. And you mentioned, you know, capital is available. I'm a fan of a fellow by the name of Edward Chancellor, mm-hmm, who's on the Asset Allocation Committee of the mutual fund giant out of Boston, GMO.
Mm-hmm.
And you may know that Chancellor is worried that China is an enormous bubble in itself that may burst here one of these days, in part because they pegged to the dollar. The dollar is becoming less valuable, and in part because they are encouraging a lot of misallocation of capital in order to keep people employed. So.
Well, Mike, Bill had me watch this 14 or 15 minute spot on SBS
Dateline.
SBS Dateline, which basically actually shows you that a fair percentage of their GDP is dedicated to building structures in throughout these newly created cities that are totally or almost totally unoccupied.
Yeah, Mike, it's funny you've mentioned this, because I had Chuck watch this video, and what was going to be called the Great Mall of China, which was built in 2005, is now being called the Not So Great Mall because it's 6 years old and there's hardly any activity in it whatsoever. And it's funny you mentioned Chancellor. We're a big fan of his work. And also GMO's research director, Ben Inker. And we happen to hold the same view that Chancellor does at our firm. And your point is super well taken. The peg to our currency stopped the Chinese currency from appreciating as they took in all those foreign currency reserves. And the only other two countries in the history of the world that had as massive foreign currency reserves as China does right now was the United States in 1929 and Japan in 1989. And so all these people that say because you've got massive foreign currency reserves that you're not going to get stuck with your real estate bubble and you're not going to have a downfall from it don't know history very
well. Sure. And, of course, there's the old joke in banking that I like to tell. You'll know it, Bill. It's borrow $1,000 and the bank owns you. Borrow $1,000,000 and you own the bank. And we need to repeat that right after somebody tells us that China has, 3.5 trillion of foreign exchange reserves. A good share of that is United States Treasury obligations. As one commentator said in the Financial Times, instead of complaining about China, we ought to send them a box of chocolates and a thank you note. They send lots of stuff over here, and we send back little tiny pieces of paper that say, I owe you. And you wonder how long that will hold up. Well, you might be interested to know, I read this just this week in the Washington Post, China's famed bullet trains have been slowed to 30 miles an hour because of safety concerns. And Edward Chancellor, actually 2 months ago, wrote in the Financial Times that there were a lot of parallels between what is happening in China and the railroad boom and bust in the United States in the period roughly from 1865 to 1870.
You are truly a peach, Mike. The talk I'm doing tomorrow includes a segment on from 1800 to 1900, the United States grew 9% on average nominal. The average interest rate during the 1800s in the United States was 5%. So we grew on a real basis, 4% compounded for 100 years. There were 15 recessions and 4 depressions. One of the biggest depressions was the bust that followed building the railroad system. And boy, there was a lot of investors that lost an awful lot of money loaning and putting equity into building the railroad system in the Western United States. And it was 10 to 20 to 30 years really before there were enough people to utilize it enough to make it profitable. And that's exactly what's going on in China. They built a lot of these structures and infrastructure. And it's great to have a fantastic airport, but if your average citizen is making $4,500 or $6,000 a year, they're never going to use the airport for a long, long time.
Well, Chancellor points out they built all, actually a fellow by the name of Charles Lane in the Washington Post, I think on Sunday, pointed out they built all these bullet trains, but the price of the tickets is so high that the average person takes the bus because he or she can't afford the bullet train.
Right. That contradiction exists in condo purchases. You know, the average citizen can't afford to build all these homes they're building. There's estimated to be 64 million homes that in China that aren't using electricity because no one's in them.
And talk about a housing bubble. Yeah. How about that? We know how that turned out, don't we, Bill? Yeah.
Let me jump in here just to remind listeners that they are listening to Getting Your Dough to Rise on KSER in Everett at 90.7 FM. And the barrel full of laughs that I have here with me are Michael Parks on the phone and Bill Smead. I'm not quite sure how to take all this in. I mean, it sounds like what happens if and when China does implode? What's the reverberation over here? Uh-oh. Nobody's got the answer.
No, it's going to be tough. You know, China's been the engine. Think of what's happened. I guess one thing I will say is that the price at the pump will go down.
Yeah.
and the price of copper and aluminum and tin and other things will go down. you know, the price of gold and silver, which I suspect Bill might agree with me that you have to wonder if those aren't bubbles.
Chuck, I'm beginning to wonder if Mike hasn't had a tape recorder or something planted in my office these days. he's hit the nail right on the head.
Sure.
The United States had the deepest recession, came very close to entering depression-type conditions in 70 years. We've had an anemic economic recovery that includes no benefit from a rebound in housing, which is a normal early-stage driver of economic recovery in the United States. So there's virtually no housing recovery yet, an anemic recovery. But yet, he's already mentioned, we have lumber prices and copper prices, which we're the largest user of copper and lumber in the world, and we're not building any houses and we're not using any. But yet the prices are enormously high. So actually, we think the first reaction to China hitting the wall will be obviously a negative attitude. There's an amazing amount of money tied up in the idea that those folks are going to have uninterrupted growth. So the disappointment for Caterpillar and other heavy industrial and cyclical and energy-related companies that at the margin, the Chinese were the buyer at the margin of all those different inputs or infrastructure-related construction-oriented businesses, they're going to take a big hit. And we look for kind of a bifurcated stock market, the way that the market bifurcated when the tech bubble burst and tech stocks went down, but really not much else besides the techs went down. It's just that they were 40% of the stock market by that time. So the first reaction will be kind of a hit to the stock market led by the belief in the brick trade going away. The second reaction, though, would be that, hey, here's the United States consumer and economy that's learned to live inside its mean for 4 or 5 years, and all of a sudden input prices get very reasonable, maybe at the time that the housing might start to pick up, maybe a year and a half, 2 years down the road. So we actually have a pretty optimistic take, and we think people don't recognize what Mike was saying, that transfer payment from the CD earner to the person owning gold or the person owning energy stocks is not a particularly favorable one for economic growth purposes. It'd be better to pay our seniors some more interest and let the people speculating in energy and commodities to lose some money for a while.
Brick is Brazil, Russia, India, China.
Yeah.
So they're not the places to be if this scenario plays out.
That's a big part of our argument in the talk that we do tomorrow.
Do you agree with this much,
well,
Mike?
Well, and I agree. And then, Bill, I think when you think about bubbles, think about the articles that we've read in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times about the new gold rush in California for the next people looking for the next Google, the next Twitter, the next Groupon, where these companies are being valued in private markets. I think I read in the Wall Street Journal that some young kids down there are meeting with investors and they're on the cell phone, and the valuations are being raised as they're on the cell phone negotiating with the venture capital people.
Yeah.
And that reminds me an awful lot of 1998, 1999,
when
anybody who could fog up a mirror.
Yeah, so
which we're still climbing back to get to.
And, right.
And again, which Mark is effectively arguing the kind of bifurcation that we think as capital became incredibly inexpensive and liquid to the creditworthy corporation, et cetera, the urge to take risk on things of that nature or on commodities or on gold and silver, et cetera, has been very high.
Sure.
And on the other hand, a effective corporation that is not brick trade related is moseying along here trading at about a 10% discount to the average stock with an outstanding balance sheet and the ability to generate high free cash flow and raise dividends. And those stocks have been, for the most part, been ignored the last 2 years in the recovery while people got excited about selling earth movers to China.
It just makes the press conference coming from Ben Bernanke tomorrow all that much more interesting.
Is that the reason why the market went up about 1% today, or is because people are already gaming what the press conference is going to be about?
Basically, I'll leave that one to Bill.
That he's going to continue with the idea that we will continue with the QE2 if need be.
We believe that we're in the late stages of of Cinderella's ball, I think Warren Buffett likes to call it. You know, everything's great, you stay at the party, but that at midnight the clock is going to strike midnight, and then everything turns to pumpkins and mice. So, for example, Cummins Engine reported fantastic earnings. Sales were up year to year in China 66% and in Brazil 39%. So their stock was up 8% today.
Yes, the earnings that have been coming in for this quarter have been much better than expected,
but,
haven't they?
But the Chinese are tightening credit, and most of the money that they're going to be able to access this year was accessible in the first quarter of this year. So if you've been selling a lot of stuff to China, The Chinese people that are doing business with those government-owned Chinese banks borrowed every dollar they could get their hands on the first quarter and did everything that they could do because they knew that later in the year the window might close up as they tighten credit to try to fight off this food and energy inflation that really hits those low-income average citizens very hard. So, they're having that excitement right now. Cat hit 111 and Cummins hit 116 today, and that we think you're getting that last burst of energy before the patient gets ready to keel over.
Okay, so they just kind of front-loaded a lot of their activity and don't expect much in the rest of the year.
But let me give you a couple of typical watershed warning signs. Glencore, the world's largest commodity trading organization, international trading organization, is attempting to go public right now. Barrick Gold announced today that they're going to try to buy a major copper producer, that they're not happy just being in the gold business now. They want to diversify into copper.
Well, that makes sense, doesn't it?
Caterpillar bought Bucyrus International, one of the two large mining equipment companies. The other one, Joy Global, trades at about 9 times book value, and they used to be called Harnish Figure Industries out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and they came out of bankruptcy in 2001 at book value, and now they trade at 9 times book. So in the world of manufacturing, 9 times book to 2 times book for the S&P is a lot like paying 80 times earnings or 100 times earnings to buy Cisco Systems back in 1999.
Well, they must be expecting a lot of growth out of Joy Global.
Well, the moment that China hits the wall, you don't need the copper and you don't need the iron ore and you don't need that stuff because suddenly they're no longer building pyramids in China, which effectively, I mean, you look at all these societies that go get a huge boom going, and what do? They go out and build all these gigantic buildings and orifices to try to say, aren't we doing great? We're right up there with the United States of America. Aren't we doing great?
Bill, you would, I'm sure you know, Fortune used to run a cover story every couple of years when housing was going like a house of fire, and I remember well one of their lines. It went something like this. It said, when you are in a bubble, when you're in the frenzy of a bubble, it is the people who are acting irrationally who look like the geniuses, and people who are acting rationally look like the chumps.
Right.
And I remember that because I used to go to cocktail parties in the late 1990s, and I'd hear people talking about their internet stocks, their JDSUs and their other, internet cable, light cable and that sort of thing. And I wasn't playing, and I kind of felt left out.
Yeah.
And of course, some of those people lost because they were so heavily invested in internet and the dot-com boom. They are now working when they wish they had been retired because they put so much of their money into those stocks.
Chuck asked me earlier, in our 29 stocks, we did kind of an analysis, a rescreening of them, and I think the most profit that any of our businesses gets from China is McDonald's, which gets about 2% of their profit. Now, just to give you a comparison, Yum Brands, which owns KFC, Taco Bell, and Pizza Hut, they get 30% of their profits from China right now. So you're absolutely right. As a value investor, this right before the clock strikes 12 is when you just feel foolish, but you know that if you stay around until the end of the party, you're going to get a hangover that you're going to regret the very next good. Day. And that's what you were talking about back in 99. I remember that so well. My neighbors were doubling their money on IPOs, on dot-com IPOs, sure. and I sat there with legitimate businesses at low price earnings ratios and paying great dividends, and no one wanted to talk to me.
Well, you had the whole NASDAQ index go up 85% that year.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not one or two stocks. That's the whole index.
Yeah, and almost all of those technology companies were based in the United States of America. So everyone from around the world had to come and invest in our country to get at that. So it was just the most amazing concentration of money in, you know, three or four main industries there. You almost never see that. It's the most concentrated the market's ever gotten in my, you know, 53 years of life.
And I remember when that crashed, the NASDAQ crashed in 2000, I was wondering, it had gotten up to 5,000, and
right.
then it came down to 1,700, or I don't know what it was, but yeah. I was wondering when it would get back to 5,000, whether it would take a decade. And here we are a decade later, and it's only halfway back.
It's Chuck, your point is so well taken. People ask me about gold, and I'm no special expert in commodities in the slightest. But I tell them, I say, look, you should probably sell some at 1,200 and 1,300 and 1,400, 1,500. They say, why should I do that, Bill? It might go to 2,000. I say, you're right. But on the way back down, there might not be a bid at 1,400 and 1,500. So in other words, your one chance to sell is on the way up at those prices. Just ask the people that own Enron, for example. You could sell all you want at 20 and 30 and 40 and 50 on the way up on Enron, but on the way down, there is no bid. And that's what always happens with a bubble, is liquidity disappears and there's no bid. And what's wrong is people stay at the party too long. And, you know, from our mutual fund standpoint, what's going to, God willing, we think what's going to be created is very outsized performance, because we have virtually no energy, no basic materials, no heavy industrial. We are virtually insulated as much as we can possibly be and have a diversified mutual fund, and we're insulated from that trade breaking that Mike has introduced to us.
But you also mentioned gold as a possible plummeting asset, but gold correlates least to the stock market of any of the other assets, as far as I know. And if the stock market plummeted, who's to say that it wouldn't be a rush to gold?
I thought Mike might comment on that, because the QE1 and the QE2, what that's done, it's pretty much risky assets, liquid risky assets, have all kind of moved in tandem, right? There's been incredibly high correlation. So the same thing that drives the enthusiasm for those yet to be public tech companies that Mike's talking about, the same enthusiasm that there is for Caterpillar and Cummins, is the same enthusiasm there is for gold and silver, the same enthusiasm there is for coffee and cotton. It's all the same thing. If emerging markets are not going to have the normal contractions that the United States had between 1800 and 1900, then there's almost an unlimited constant demand at the margin for these scarce things, and therefore the theory is they'll go up. In other words, the theory this time is China will have uninterrupted growth. The theory in 1999 was that the internet was going to change our lives. The beauty of what we call the well-known fact is that the worst well-known facts are when you're right. In other words, China might be very successful 20 years from now, but by not having a contraction in their economy for the last 20 years, they're setting up a doozy of a contraction, mm-hmm. which means that they might be very successful in 20 years, but they're going to probably have a 4 or 5 year depression type circumstance if, in fact, Ed Chancellor is right, and their real estate market hits the wall, which causes huge development losses on the lending side, causes them to have to recapitalize their banking system, which will be the net seller of treasuries over the next 5 to 10 years as they recapitalize their banking system from all the money that's been loaned on buildings that have no occupants.
Well, let me just, I've noticed here that we only have about 10 more minutes for the show. So, Mike, I'm going to ask you for any final words that you might like to put on this, rather negative negative outlook that we have here.
I guess the one thing we should say, I mean, we worry, and I think we rightly worry about whether we have bubbles today. We also have to recognize that over the past decade or so, that literally millions and millions of people around the world, hasn't been a great decade for the U.S., but millions and millions of people around the world have been lifted out of abject poverty and are now enjoying, you know, some of the material goods that we take for granted. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want to take away from that. But we do have to keep an eye on the idea of bubbles. Memories are short in financial markets, and I can't recommend more strongly the Ed Chancellor. There's a white paper, Red Flags, China's Red Flags, available on the GMO website. It was published in March of 2010. It's well worth running down. And as a last word, I would say please visit MichaelJParks.com, where I'm the webmaster, and send me a note if you find anything interesting there.
Well, thanks, Mike. And by the way, you're going to be on NPR tomorrow?
I will, yeah, Seattle.
What NPR time is that?
KUOW 94.9, about 10:20 for 40 minutes. I will be in South Snohomish County at a EDC event on May 4th as a panelist with three or four other folks as well.
Okay. Great for thank you for joining in with us today.
Great to be with you, Mike.
Yeah.
Great fun, and great. Best to you, Bill, and best to you, Chuck.
Great having you.
Thank you.
Take care. That's Michael Parks, editor emeritus of the Marples Northwest Business Letter in Seattle. And we've only got about 7 or 8 minutes, and I wanted to make sure that we had a little bit of open phone possibility here for anybody who is listening that wanted to call in with a question. It seems like about the only thing that we've been talking about is China, but I would like to talk about a couple other issues. And if someone else had a question, please give us a call. The number here is 425-303-9070. The one thing that I wanted to bring up, and that is, Bill, that 20 years ago, to my mind, there was a lot more discussion on the demographics of this country than there is now, even though the demographics is at the point where it's going to start falling off the cliff. The baby boom is retiring. You're going to start getting the Social Security checks. Going to start using Medicare. In fact, I heard that the average Medicare recipient gets $450,000. Now, I don't know if I should believe this or not, but they get $450,000 in Medicare, to which they only paid in $150,000 during their career. That's not a very good way to run an insurance company. And we've got Social Security, to me, seems like something you can whittle around the edge and not have a problem with. But Medicare seems like a major impediment to our budget, running our federal budget. And then when you turn it over to the people, they don't like this deficit and this debt that we're running. But they don't want to give up the Medicare. They don't want to give up the Social Security. They don't want to. There's doesn't seem to be a way to tackle this thing.
Well, in our fund, and by the way, our fund symbol is SMVLX. S is in Sam, M is in Mary, V is in Victor, LX. And our website is smeadcap.com is our website. In the portfolio, we are overweighted healthcare. And if you, in fact, attempt to attack some of those cost inefficiencies in Medicare, a lot of people don't know this, but about the most cost-effective way to treat people is actually through pharmaceutical products. Pharmaceutical products, or medicine, is about 8% of the total United States healthcare cost. So if you do end up with a very large group of folks over the age of 70, which we're statistically very likely to have in the next 10 to 20 years, a very large group over 70, and therefore large users of the Medicare system, the default might be that rather than have all the surgeries and all the things that the federal government might actually become a lot more enthusiastic about backing efforts by the medicine makers to come up with medicines that might avoid some of those more expensive treatments and more expensive ways of dealing with the last couple of years of your life.
Okay, but then the pharmaceuticals is a perfectly good example. A lot of people will opt for the brand drug, the mm-hmm. patented drug, when they can get the generic for maybe 10%, 20% the price. But they're going to take the brand drug because they might think it's better, even though it isn't in almost all cases. But they also think, well, I'm going to take the brand drug because I'm paying premiums for my insurance, and I'm entitled to the brand drug.
Well,
what they don't understand is if they're going to take the brand drug instead of the generic, their premiums are going to increase next year.
Yeah, we own Mylan Labs, a generic, the second or largest, third largest worldwide generic drug manufacturer is Mylan Labs. We own that stock and like it a great deal. The Paul Ryan proposal says give the money that you're going to spend in that arena to the citizen and let them use their great American shopping instincts to reduce the cost of healthcare by making good choices about what to do with that money that's been set aside for them. And that's an interesting debate because one side says, oh, how can you do that? And then we look and say, how could Costco exist if the United States of America isn't made up of a bunch of people that love to shop for bargains? So I happen to kind of fall on the Paul Ryan side of this debate. Let's give American consumers, put the money and the decisions in their hands and let them make those decisions themselves. And you might allocate capital a lot more efficiently than you have in the past. And so I happen to fall in that camp. I believe that the invisible hand of the consumer has a tendency to allocate resources a lot better. And I think the American public is a lot smarter than we give them credit for. I think if you look at the way most people do their grocery shopping, you deal with this on your program regularly. Some of your most popular guests are people that come on, explain to people how to go about getting better bargains. We don't do that in healthcare because an insurance company makes the payments for the services rather than the person that receives the services.
But does the Paul Ryan plan take care of the lower income individuals?
Yeah, oh, sure it does. And that's the thing you have to remember. Think of Merck. You know, Merck has a scholarship program for people at lower incomes to get the pharmaceutical products they need. All the big pharmaceutical companies have agreed to fill that donut in the donut between the plans and offer 50% up to 50% discounts on pharmaceutical products. And then, of course, in foreign countries where people have much lower incomes, they sell their products at much lower prices.
Another thing, and we've only got about a minute, but it was brought up to me by someone here at the station who has a daughter that'll be going to college next year, mm-hmm. that the funding for college has gone up much faster than the rate of inflation, that students have student loans that are 40, 50, 60, 70, maybe even triple digits, and they come out of school. Yeah. And right now they come out of school and there isn't even a job ready for them. But here's a whole sector of our population, besides the ones that have had all their homes foreclosed on them and everybody else. Here's a sector of the population that you're not going to be able to expect much discretionary spending from.
Chuck, the people believe that a totalitarian communist government in China is making good capital allocation decisions, but yet where the government is most involved in capital allocation decisions in the parts of our lives where the government is involved in capital allocation decisions, like education, our system isn't working very well. So the answer is central planning doesn't do a very good job, but people acting in their own self-interest who do control their spending can have a major impact. So I agree with you. Maybe that's another show for us to talk about that, because I'd love to. There's a massive misallocation of resources in the education area, and I agree with you. I think it's amazing that we spend the kind of money on college education that we do.
Yeah. Well, I thank you once again, Bill, for coming in to the studio, and I'd love to have you back sometime in the future. And good luck on your a seminar tomorrow with this reversion to the mean subject, and I guess you're going to be covering the Chinese situation along with five or six other categories. And let me just mention to my listeners that this is Bill Smead here in the studio with me, who founder, chief executive officer, and chief investment officer at Smead Capital Management in Seattle, and he's the portfolio manager of the Smead Capital Fund. And on the phone with us for a lot of the hour was Michael Parks, the editor emeritus of Marple's Northwest Business Letter. And that's about it for this month, but I want to remind you that Getting Your Dough to Rise is on the last Tuesday of every month. So I will return, and I trust you will too, on May 31st, the last Tuesday of May, for another episode of Getting Your Dough to Rise. Getting Your Dough to Rise is a public affairs. I'm sorry. The content of Getting Your Dough to Rise is informational in nature and should not be construed as advice on investment strategies, nor are the views of the program's guests endorsed by KSCR staff or management. Getting Your Dough to Rise is a public affairs production of your community radio station, KSER.